Chapter 28. The Père Blanchard's Hut. As in a dream, Marguerite followed on. The web was drawing more and more tightly every moment round the beloved life, which had become dearer than all. To see her husband once again, to tell him how she had suffered, how much she had wronged, and how little understood him, had become now her only aim. She had abandoned all hope of saving him. She saw him gradually hemmed in on all sides, and, in despair, she gazed round her into the darkness, and wondered whence he would presently come to fall into the death-trap which his relentless enemy had prepared for him. The distant roar of the waves now made her shudder. The occasional dismal cry of an owl or a seagull filled her with unspeakable horror. She thought of the ravenous beasts, in human shape, who lay in wait for their prey, and destroyed them as mercilessly as any hungry wolf for the satisfaction of their own appetite of hate. Marguerite was not afraid of the darkness. She only feared that man on ahead who was sitting at the bottom of a rough wooden cart, nursing thoughts of vengeance which would have made the very demons in hell chuckle with delight. Her feet were sore. Her knees shook under her from sheer bodily fatigue. For days now she had lived in a wild turmoil of excitement. She had not had a quiet rest for 3 nights. Now she had walked on a slippery road for nearly 2 hours, and yet her determination never swerved for a moment. She would see her husband, tell him all, and if he was ready to forgive the crime which she had committed in her blind ignorance, she would yet have the happiness of dying by his side. She must have walked on almost in a trance, instinct alone keeping her up and guiding her in the wake of the enemy, when suddenly her ears, attuned to the slightest sound by that same blind instinct, told her that the cart had stopped, and that the soldiers had halted. They had come to their destination. No doubt on the right, somewhere close ahead, was the footpath that led to the edge of the cliff and to the hut. Heedless of any risks, she crept quite close up to where Chauvelin stood, surrounded by his little troop. He had descended from the cart and was giving some orders to the men. These she wanted to hear. What little chance she yet had of being useful to Percy consisted in hearing absolutely every word of his enemy's plans. The spot where all the party had halted must have lain some 800 meters from the coast. The sound of the sea came only very faintly, as from a distance. Chauvelin and Degas, followed by the soldiers, had turned off sharply to the right of the road, apparently onto the footpath which led to the cliffs. The Jew had remained on the road with his cart and nag. Marguerite, with infinite caution and literally crawling on her hands and knees, had also turned off to the right. To accomplish this, she had to creep through the rough, low shrubs, trying to make as little noise as possible as she went along, tearing her face and hands against the dry twigs, intent only upon hearing without being seen or heard. Fortunately, as is usual in this part of France, the footpath was bordered by a low, rough hedge, beyond which was a dry ditch, filled with coarse grass. In this, Marguerite managed to find shelter. She was quite hidden from view, yet could contrive to get within 3 yards of where Chauvelin stood, giving orders to his men.
"Now," he was saying in a low and peremptory whisper, "where is the Père Blanchard's hut?"
"About 800 meters from here, along the footpath,"
said the soldier, who had lately been directing the party,
"and halfway down the cliff."
"Very good. You shall lead us. Before we begin to descend the cliff, you shall creep down to the hut as noiselessly as possible and ascertain if the traitor royalists are there. Do you understand?"
"I understand, citoyen."
"Now listen very attentively, all of you,"
continued Chauvelin impressively, and addressing the soldiers collectively,
"for after this we may not be able to exchange another word, so remember every syllable I utter, as if your very lives depended on your memory."
"Perhaps they do," he added dryly.
"We listen, citoyen,"
said Degas,
"and a soldier of the Republic never forgets an order. You, who have crept up to the hut, will try to peep inside. If an Englishman is there with those traitors, a man who is tall above the average, or who stoops as if he would disguise his height, then give a sharp, quick whistle as a signal to your comrades. All of you,"
he added, once more speaking to the soldiers collectively,
"then quickly surround and rush into the hut, and each seize one of the men there, before they have time to draw their firearms. If any of them struggle, shoot at their arms or legs, but on no account kill the tall man. Do you understand?"
"We understand, citoyen." "The man who is tall above the average is probably also strong above the average. It will take 4 or 5 of you at least to overpower him."
There was a little pause, Then Chauvelin continued, "If the royalist traitors are still alone, which is more than likely to be the case, then warn your comrades who are lying in wait there, and all of you creep and take cover behind the rocks and boulders round the hut, and wait there, in dead silence, until the tall Englishman arrives. Then only rush the hut when he is safely within its doors. But remember that you must be as silent as the wolf is at night when he prowls around the pens. I do not wish those royalists to be on the alert. The firing of a pistol, a shriek or call on their part would be sufficient, perhaps, to warn the tall personage to keep clear of the cliffs and of the hut. And," he added emphatically, "it is the tall Englishman whom it is your duty to capture tonight." "You shall be implicitly obeyed, citoyen." "Then get along as noiselessly as possible, and I will follow you."
"What about the Jew, citoyen?" asked Degas, as silently, like noiseless shadows, one by one the soldiers began to creep along the rough and narrow footpath.
"Ah, yes, I had forgotten the Jew," said Chauvelin, and turning towards the Jew, he called him peremptorily,
"Here, you, Aaron, Moses, Abraham, or whatever your confounded name may be," he said to the old man, who had quietly stood beside his lean nag as far away from the soldiers as possible.
"Benjamin Rosenbaum, so it please your honour," he replied humbly.
"It does not please me to hear your voice, but it does please me to give you certain orders which you will find it wise to obey."
"So please your honour."
"Hold your confounded tongue. You shall stay here, do you hear, with your horse and cart until I return. You are on no account to utter the faintest sound, or to breathe even louder than you can help. Nor are you, on any consideration whatever, to leave your post until I give you orders to do so. Do you understand?"
But, your honour," protested the Jew pitiably.
"There is no question of but or of any argument," said Chauvelin, in a tone that made the timid old man tremble from head to foot. "If, when I return, I do not find you here, I most solemnly assure you that, wherever you may try and hide yourself, I can find you, and that punishment swift, sure, and terrible will sooner or later overtake you. Do you hear me?"
"But, your excellency—"
"I said, do you hear me?"
The soldiers had all crept away. The three men stood alone together in the dark and lonely road, with Marguerite there, behind the hedge, listening to Chauvelin's orders as she would to her own death sentence.
"I heard, your honour,"
protested the Jew again, while he tried to draw nearer to Chauvelin, "and I swear by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that I would obey your honour most absolutely, and that I would not move from this place until your honour once more deigned to shed the light of your countenance upon your humble servant. But remember, your honour, I am a poor old man. My nerves are not as strong as those of a young soldier. If midnight marauders should come prowling round this lonely road, I might scream or run in my fright. And is my life to be forfeit? Is some terrible punishment to come on my poor old head for that which I cannot help?" The Jew seemed in real distress. He was shaking from head to foot. Clearly he was not the man to be left by himself on this lonely road. The man spoke truly. He might unwittingly, in sheer terror, utter the shriek that might prove a warning to the wily Scarlet Pimpernel. Chauvelin reflected for a moment.
"Will your horse and cart be safe alone here, do you think?" he asked roughly. "I fancy, citoyen," here interposed Degas, "that they will be safer without that dirty cowardly Jew as with him. There seems no doubt that if he gets scared he will either make a bolt of it or shriek his head off."
"But what am I to do with the brute?"
"Will you send him back to Calais, citoyen?"
"No,
for we shall want him to drive back the wounded presently," said Chauvelin with grim significance.
There was a pause again, Degas waiting for the decision of his chief, and the old Jew whining beside his nag.
"Well, you lazy, lumbering old coward," said Chauvelin at last, "you had better shuffle along behind us. Yes, citoyen Degas, tie this handkerchief tightly round the fellow's mouth."
Chauvelin handed a scarf to Degas, who solemnly began winding it round the Jew's mouth. Meekly, Benjamin Rosenbaum allowed himself to be gagged. He, evidently, preferred this uncomfortable state to that of being left alone on the dark Saint-Martin road. Then the three men fell in line.
"Quick," said Chauvelin impatiently, "we have already wasted much valuable time."
And the firm footsteps of Chauvelin and Degas, the shuffling gait of the old Jew, soon died away along the footpath. Marguerite had not lost a single one of Chauvelin's words of command. Her every nerve was strained to completely grasp the situation first, then to make a final appeal to those wits which had so often been called the sharpest in Europe, and which alone might be of service now. Certainly the situation was desperate enough. A tiny band of unsuspecting men quietly awaiting the arrival of their rescuer, who was equally unconscious of the trap laid for them all. It seemed so horrible, this net, as it were drawn in a circle at dead of night on a lonely beach round a few defenceless men. Defenceless because they were tricked and unsuspecting. Of these, one was the husband she idolized, another the brother she loved. She vaguely wondered who the others were, who were also calmly waiting for the Scarlet Pimpernel, while death lurked behind every boulder of the cliffs. For the moment she could do nothing but follow the soldiers and Chauvelin. She feared to lose her way, or she would have rushed forward and found that wooden hut, and perhaps been in time to warn the fugitives and their brave deliverer yet. For a second, the thought flashed through her mind of uttering the piercing shrieks which Chauvelin seemed to dread as a possible warning to the Scarlet Pimpernel and his friends, in the wild hope that they would hear and have yet time to escape before it was too late. But she did not know how far from the edge of the cliff she was. She did not know if her shrieks would reach the ears of the doomed men. Her effort might be premature, and she would never be allowed to make another. Her mouth would be securely gagged like that of the Jew, and she, a helpless prisoner in the hands of Chauvelin's men. Like a ghost, she flitted noiselessly behind that hedge. She had taken her shoes off, and her stockings were by now torn off her feet. She felt neither soreness nor weariness. Indomitable will to reach her husband in spite of adverse fate, and of a cunning enemy, killed all sense of bodily pain within her, and rendered her instincts doubly acute. She heard nothing save the soft and measured footsteps of Percy's enemies on in front. She saw nothing but, in her mind's eye, that wooden hut, and he, her husband, walking blindly to his doom. Suddenly, those same keen instincts within her made her pause in her mad haste, and cower still further within the shadow of the hedge. The moon, which had provided a friend to her by remaining hidden behind a bank of clouds, now emerged in all the glory of an early autumn night, and in a moment flooded the weird and lonely landscape with a rush of brilliant light. There, not 200 meters ahead, was the edge of the cliff, and below, stretching far away to free and happy England, the sea rolled on smoothly and peaceably. Marguerite's gaze rested for an instant on the brilliant silvery waters, and as she gazed, her heart, which had been numb with pain for all these hours, seemed to soften and distend, and her eyes filled with hot tears. Not 3 miles away, with white sails set, a graceful schooner lay in wait. Marguerite had guessed rather than recognized her. It was the Daydream, Percy's favourite yacht, with old Briggs, that prince of skippers, aboard, and all her crew of British sailors. Her white sails, glistening in the moonlight, seemed to convey a message to Marguerite of joy and hope, which yet she feared could never be. She waited there, out at sea, waited for her master, like a beautiful white bird all ready to take flight, and he would never reach her, never see her smooth deck again, never gaze any more on the white cliffs of England, the land of liberty and of hope. The sight of the schooner seemed to infuse into the poor, wearied woman the superhuman strength of despair. There was the edge of the cliff, and some way below was the hut, where presently her husband would meet his death. But the moon was out. She could see her way now. She would see the hut from a distance, run to it, rouse them all, warn them at any rate to be prepared, and to sell their lives dearly, rather than be caught like so many rats in a hole. She stumbled on behind the hedge in the low, thick grass of the ditch. She must have run on very fast, and had outdistanced Chauvelin and Degas, for presently she reached the edge of the cliff, and heard their footsteps distinctly behind her. But only a very few yards away, and now the moonlight was full upon her, a figure must have been distinctly silhouetted against the silvery background of the sea. Only for a moment, though. The next she had cowered like some animal, doubled up within itself. She peeped down the great rugged cliffs. The descent would be easy enough, as they were not precipitous, and the great boulders afforded plenty of foothold. Suddenly, as she gazed, she saw at some little distance on her left, and about midway down the cliffs, a rough wooden construction, through the walls of which a tiny red light glimmered like a beacon. Her very heart seemed to stand still, The eagerness of joy was so great that it felt like an awful pain. She could not gauge how distant the hut was, but without hesitation she began the steep descent, creeping from boulder to boulder, caring nothing for the enemy behind or for the soldiers, who evidently had all taken cover since the tall Englishman had not yet appeared. On she pressed, forgetting the deadly foe on her track, running, stumbling, footsore, half-dazed, but still on, when suddenly a crevice or stone or slippery bit of rock threw her violently to the ground. She struggled again to her feet and started running forward once more to give them that timely warning, to beg them to flee before he came, and to tell him to keep away, away from this death-trap, away from this awful doom. But now she realized that other steps, quicker than her own, were already close at her heels. The next instant a hand dragged at her skirt, and she was down on her knees again, whilst something was wound round her mouth to prevent her uttering a scream. Bewildered, half-frantic with the bitterness of disappointment, she looked round her helplessly, and, bending down quite close to her, she saw through the mist which seemed to gather round her a pair of keen, malicious eyes which appeared to her excited brain to have a weird, supernatural green light in them. She lay in the shadow of a great boulder. Chauvelin could not see her features, but he passed his thin, white fingers over her face.
"A woman," he whispered, "by all the saints in the calendar." "We cannot let her loose, that's certain," he muttered to himself. "I wonder now."
Suddenly he paused, and after a few seconds of deadly silence he gave forth a long, low, curious chuckle, while once again Marguerite felt, with a horrible shudder, his thin fingers wandering over her face.
"Dear me, dear me," he whispered with affected gallantry. "Oh, this is indeed a charming surprise."
And Marguerite felt her resistless hand raised to Chauvelin's thin, mocking lips. The situation was indeed grotesque, had it not been at the same time so fearfully tragic. The poor, weary woman, broken in spirit and half-frantic with the bitterness of her disappointment, receiving on her knees the banal gallantries of her deadly enemy. Her senses were leaving her. Half-choked with the tight grip round her mouth, she had no strength to move or to utter the faintest sound. The excitement which all along had kept up her delicate body seemed at once to have subsided, and the feeling of blank despair to have completely paralysed her brain and nerves. Chauvelin must have given some directions which she was too dazed to hear, for she felt herself lifted from off her feet, the bandage round her mouth was made more secure, and a pair of strong arms carried her towards that tiny red light on ahead, which she had looked upon as a beacon and the last faint glimmer of hope. Chapter 29. Trapped. She did not know how long she was thus carried along. She had lost all notion of time and space, and for a few seconds tired nature, mercifully, deprived her of consciousness. When she once more realized her state, she felt that she was placed with some degree of comfort upon a man's coat, with her back resting against a fragment of rock. The moon was hidden again behind some clouds, and the darkness seemed in comparison more intense. The sea was roaring some 200 feet below her, and on looking all round she could no longer see any vestige of the tiny glimmer of red light. That the end of the journey had been reached she gathered from the fact that she heard rapid questions and answers spoken in a whisper quite close to her.
"There are 4 men in there, citoyen. They are sitting by the fire and seem to be waiting quietly."
"The hour?"
"Nearly 2 o'clock.
"The tide?"
"Coming in quickly."
"The schooner?"
"Obviously an English one, lying some 3 kilometres out, but we cannot see her boat."
"Have the men taken cover?"
"Oh yes, citoyen."
"They will not blunder?"
"They will not stir until the tall Englishman comes. Then they will surround and overpower the 5 men.
"Right. And the lady?"
"Oh, still dazed, I fancy. She's close behind you, citoyen."
"And the Jew?"
"He's gagged, and his legs strapped together. He cannot move or scream."
"Good. Then have your gun ready in case you want it. Get close to the hut and leave me to look after the lady."
Degas evidently obeyed, for Marguerite heard him creeping away along the stony cliff. Then she felt that a pair of warm, thin, talon-like hands took hold of both her own and held them in a grip of steel.
"Before that handkerchief is removed from your pretty mouth, fair lady," whispered Chauvelin close to her ear, I think it right to give you one small word of warning. What has procured me the honour of being followed across the channel by so charming a companion, I cannot, of course, conceive. But, if I mistake not, the purpose of this flattering attention is not one that would commend itself to my vanity. And I think that I am right in surmising, moreover, that the first sound which your pretty lips would utter as soon as the cruel gag is removed would be one that would perhaps prove a warning to the cunning fox which I have been at such pains to track to his lair. He paused a moment, while the steel-like grasp seemed to tighten round her wrist. Then he resumed in the same hurried whisper, "Inside that hut, if again I am not mistaken, your brother, Armand Saint-Just, waits with the traitor de Tournay, and two other men unknown to you, for the arrival of the mysterious rescuer whose identity has for so long puzzled our Committee of Public Safety, the audacious Scarlet Pimpernel. No doubt, if you scream, if there is a scuffle here, if shots are fired, it is more than likely that the same long legs that brought this Scarlet Enigma here will as quickly take him to some place of safety. The purpose, then, for which I have travelled all these miles will remain unaccomplished. On the other hand, it only rests with yourself that your brother, Armand, shall be free to go off with you tonight, if you like, to England or any other place of safety." Marguerite could not utter a sound, as the handkerchief was wound very tightly round her mouth. But Chauvelin was peering through the darkness very closely into her face. No doubt, too, her hand gave a responsive appeal to his last suggestion, for presently he continued, "What I want you to do to ensure Armand's safety is a very simple thing, dear lady." "What is it?" Marguerite's hand seemed to convey to his in response. "To remain on this spot, without uttering a sound, until I give you leave to speak." "Ah, but I think you will obey," he added, with that funny, dry chuckle of his, as Marguerite's whole figure seemed to stiffen in defiance of this order. "For let me tell you that if you scream, nay, if you utter one sound, or attempt to move from here, my men, there are 30 of them about, will seize Saint-Just, de Tournay, and their two friends, and shoot them here, by my orders, before your eyes." Marguerite had listened to her implacable enemy's speech with ever-increasing terror. Numbed with physical pain, she had yet sufficient mental vitality in her to realize the full horror of this terrible either-or he was once more putting before her. An either-or 10,000 times more appalling and horrible than the one he had suggested to her that fatal night at the ball. This time it meant that she should keep still, and allow the husband she worshipped to walk unconsciously to his death, or that she should, by trying to give him a word of warning, which perhaps might even be unavailing, actually give the signal for her own brother's death, and that of three other unsuspecting men. She could not see Chauvelin, but she could almost feel those keen, pale eyes of his fixed maliciously upon her helpless form, and his hurried, whispered words reached her ear as the death knell of her last, faint, lingering hope. "Nay, fair lady," he added urbanely, "you can have no interest in anyone save Saint-Just, and all you need do for his safety is to remain where you are and to keep silent. My men have strict orders to spare him in every way. As for that enigmatic Scarlet Pimpernel, what is he to you? Believe me, no warning from you could possibly save him. And now, dear lady, let me remove this unpleasant coercion which has been placed before your pretty mouth. You see, I wish you to be perfectly free in the choice which you are about to make." Her thoughts in a whirl, her temples aching, her nerves paralyzed, her body numb with pain, Marguerite sat there in the darkness which surrounded her as with a pall. From where she sat she could not see the sea, but she heard the incessant, mournful murmur of the incoming tide, which spoke of her dead hopes, her lost love, the husband she had with her own hand betrayed and sent to his death. Chauvelin removed the handkerchief from her mouth. She certainly did not scream. At that moment she had no strength to do anything but barely to hold herself upright and to force herself to think. Oh, think, think, think of what she should do. The minutes flew on. In this awful stillness she could not tell how fast or how slowly. She heard nothing, she saw nothing. She did not feel the sweet-smelling autumn air scented with the briny odour of the sea. She no longer heard the murmur of the waves, the occasional rattling of a pebble as it rolled down some steep incline. More and more unreal did the whole situation seem. It was impossible that she, Marguerite Blakeney, the Queen of London society, should actually be sitting here on this bit of lonely coast in the middle of the night, side by side with a most bitter enemy.
And oh, it was not possible that somewhere, not many hundred feet away perhaps, from where she stood, the being she had once despised, but who now, in every moment of this weird, dreamlike life, became more and more dear. It was not possible that he was unconsciously, even now, walking to his doom, whilst she did nothing to save him. Why did she not, with unearthly screams that would re-echo from one end of the lonely beach to the other, send out a warning to him to desist, to retrace his steps, for death lurked here whilst he advanced? Once or twice the screams rose to her throat, as if by instinct. Then, before her eyes, there stood the awful alternative, her brother and those three men shot before her eyes, practically by her orders, she their murderer. Oh, that fiend in human shape, next to her, knew human, female nature well. He had played upon her feelings as a skilful musician plays upon an instrument. He had gauged her very thoughts to a nicety. She could not give that signal, for she was weak, and she was a woman. How could she deliberately order Armand to be shot before her eyes, to have his dear blood upon her head, he dying, perhaps, with a curse on her upon his lips? And little Suzanne's father, too, he, an old man, and the others. Oh, it was all too, too horrible. Wait, 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 how long? The early morning hours sped on, and yet it was not dawn. The sea continued its incessant, mournful murmur. The autumnal breeze sighed gently in the night. The lonely beach was silent, even as the grave. Suddenly, from somewhere, not very far away, a cheerful, strong voice was heard singing, "God save the King!" Chapter 30. The Schooner. Marguerite, aching heart, stood still. She felt, more than she heard, the men on the watch preparing for the fight. Her senses told her that each, with sword in hand, was crouching, ready for the spring. The voice came nearer and nearer. In the vast immensity of these lonely cliffs, with the loud murmur of the sea below, it was impossible to say how near or how far, nor yet from which direction came that cheerful singer, who sang to God to save his king, whilst he himself was in such deadly danger. Faint at first, the voice grew louder and louder. From time to time a small pebble detached itself, apparently from beneath the firm tread of the singer, and went rolling down the rocky cliffs to the beach below. Marguerite, as she heard, felt that her very life was slipping away, as if when that voice drew nearer, when that singer became entrapped. She distinctly heard the click of Degas' gun close to her. No, 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 no! O God in heaven, this cannot be! Let Armand's blood then be upon her own head! Let her be branded as his murderer! Let even he, whom she loved, despise and loathe her for this! But God, O God, save him at any cost! With a wild shriek she sprang to her feet and darted round the rock against which she had been cowering. She saw the little red gleam through the chinks of the hut. She ran up to it and fell against its wooden walls, which she began to hammer with clenched fists in an almost maniacal frenzy, while she shouted, "Armand! Armand, for God's sake, fire! Your leader is near! He is coming! He is betrayed! Armand! Armand! Fire, in heaven's name!" She was seized and thrown to the ground. She lay there moaning, bruised, not caring, but still half sobbing, half shrieking. "Percy, my husband, for God's sake, fly! Armand! Armand, why don't you fire?" "One of you stop that woman screaming," hissed Chauvelin, who hardly could refrain from striking her. Something was thrown over her face. She could not breathe, and perforce she was silent. The bold singer, too, had become silent, warned, no doubt, of his impending danger by Marguerite's frantic shrieks. The men had sprung to their feet. There was no need for further silence on their part. The very cliffs echoed the poor, heartbroken woman's screams. Chauvelin, with a muttered oath, which boded no good to her, who had dared to upset his most cherished plans, had hastily shouted the word of command. "Into it, my men, and let no one escape from that hut alive!" The moon had once more emerged from between the clouds. The darkness on the cliffs had gone, giving place once more to brilliant silvery light. Some of the soldiers had rushed to the rough wooden door of the hut, whilst one of them kept guard over Marguerite. The door was partially open. One of the soldiers pushed it further, but within all was darkness, the charcoal fire only lighting with a dim red light the furthest corner of the hut. The soldiers paused automatically at the door, like machines waiting for further orders. Chauvelin, who was prepared for a violent onslaught from within and for a vigorous resistance from the four fugitives under cover of the darkness, was for the moment paralysed with astonishment when he saw the soldiers standing there at attention like sentries on guard, whilst not a sound proceeded from the hut. Filled with strange, anxious foreboding, he too went to the door of the hut, and peering into the gloom, he asked quickly,
"What is the meaning of this?"
"I think, citoyen, that there is no one there now," replied one of the soldiers imperturbably.
"You have not let those four men go,"
thundered Chauvelin menacingly.
"I ordered you to let no man escape alive. Quick, after them, all of you, quick, in every direction."
The men, obedient as machines, rushed down the rocky incline towards the beach, some going off to right and left as fast as their feet could carry them.
"You and your men will pay with your lives for this blunder, citoyen sergeant," said Chauvelin viciously to the sergeant who had been in charge of the men. "And you too, citoyen," he added, turning with a snarl to Degas, "for disobeying my orders."
"You ordered us to wait, citoyen, until the tall Englishman arrived and joined the four men in the hut."
"No one came," said the sergeant sullenly.
"But I ordered you just now, when a woman screamed, to rush in and let no one escape."
"But, citoyen, the four men who were there before had been gone some time, I think."
"You think? You?" said Chauvelin, almost choking with fury. "And you let them go?"
"You ordered us to wait, citoyen," protested the sergeant, "and to implicitly obey your commands on pain of death. We waited. I heard the men creep out of the hut not many minutes after we took cover, and long before the woman screamed," he added, as Chauvelin seemed still quite speechless with rage.
"Hark!" said Degas suddenly.
In the distance the sound of repeated firing was heard. Chauvelin tried to peer along the beach below, but as luck would have it, the fitful moon once more hid her light behind a bank of clouds, and he could see nothing.
"One of you go into the hut and strike a light," he stammered at last.
Stolidly the sergeant obeyed. He went up to the charcoal fire and lit the small lantern he carried in his belt. It was evident that the hut was quite empty.
"Which way did they go?" asked Chauvelin.
"I could not tell, citoyen," said the sergeant. "They went straight down the cliff first, then disappeared behind some boulders."
"Hush! What was that?"
All three men listened attentively. In the far, very far distance, could be heard faintly echoing and already dying away the quick, sharp splash of half a dozen oars. Chauvelin took out his handkerchief and wiped the perspiration from his forehead.
"The schooner's boat," was all he gasped.
Evidently, Armand Saint-Just and his three companions had managed to creep along the side of the cliffs, whilst the men, like true soldiers of the well-drilled Republican army, had, with blind obedience and in fear of their lives, implicitly obeyed Chauvelin's orders to wait for the tall Englishman who was the important capture. They had no doubt reached one of the creeks which jut far out to sea on this coast at intervals. Behind this, the boat of the Daydream must have been on the lookout for them, and they were by now safely on board the British schooner. As if to confirm this last supposition, the dull boom of a gun was heard from out at sea.
"The schooner, citoyen," said Degas quietly. "She's off."
It needed all Chauvelin's nerve and presence of mind not to give way to a useless and undignified access of rage. There was no doubt now that once again that accursed British head had completely outwitted him. How he had contrived to reach the hut without being seen by one of the 30 soldiers who guarded the spot was more than Chauvelin could conceive. That he had done so before the 30 men had arrived on the cliff was, of course, fairly clear. But how he had come over in Reuben Goldstein's cart all the way from Calais without being sighted by the various patrols on duty was impossible of explanation. It really seemed as if some potent fate watched over that daring Scarlet Pimpernel, and his astute enemy almost felt a superstitious shudder pass through him as he looked round at the towering cliffs and the loneliness of this outlying coast. But surely this was reality, and the year of grace 1792, there were no fairies and hobgoblins about. Chauvelin and his 30 men had all heard with their own ears that accursed voice singing "God Save the King" full 20 minutes after they had all taken cover around the hut. By that time the four fugitives must have reached the creek and got into the boat, and the nearest creek was more than a mile from the hut. Where had that daring singer got to? Unless Satan himself had lent him wings, he could not have covered that mile on a rocky cliff in the space of 2 minutes. And only 2 minutes had elapsed between his song and the sound of the boat's oars away at sea. He must have remained behind, and was even now hiding somewhere about the cliffs. The patrols were still about. He would still be sighted, no doubt. Chauvelin felt hopeful once again. One or two of the men who had run after the fugitives were now slowly working their way up the cliff. One of them reached Chauvelin's side at the very moment that this hope arose in the astute diplomatist's heart.
"We are too late, citoyen," the soldier said. "We reached the beach just before the moon was hidden by that bank of clouds. The boat had undoubtedly been on the lookout behind that first creek a mile off, but she had shoved off some time ago when we got to the beach and was already some way out to sea. We fired after her, but of course it was no good. She was making straight and quickly for the schooner. We saw her very clearly in the moonlight." "Yes," said Chauvelin with eager impatience. "She had shoved off some time ago, you said, and the nearest creek is a mile further on."
"Yes, citoyen. I ran all the way straight to the beach, though I guessed the boat would have waited somewhere near the creek, as the tide would reach there earliest. The boat must have shoved off some minutes before the woman began to scream."
Some minutes before the woman began to scream. Then Chauvelin's hopes had not deceived him. The Scarlet Pimpernel may have contrived to send the fugitives on ahead by the boat, but he himself had not had time to reach it. He was still on shore, and all the roads were well patrolled. At any rate, all was not yet lost, and would not be whilst that impudent Britisher was still on French soil.
"Bring the light in here," he commanded eagerly as he once more entered the hut.
The sergeant brought his lantern, and together the two men explored the little place. With a rapid glance, Chauvelin noted its contents, the cauldron placed close under an aperture in the wall, and containing the last few dying embers of burned charcoal. A couple of stools, overturned as if in the haste of sudden departure, then the fisherman's tools and his nets lying in one corner, and, beside them, something small and white.
"Pick that up," said Chauvelin to the sergeant, pointing to this white scrap, "and bring it to me."
It was a crumpled piece of paper, evidently forgotten there by the fugitives in their hurry to get away. The sergeant, much awed by the citoyen's obvious rage and impatience, picked the paper up and handed it respectfully to Chauvelin.
"Read it, sergeant," said the latter curtly. "It is almost illegible, citoyen, a fearful scrawl. I ordered you to read it," repeated Chauvelin viciously.
The sergeant, by the light of his lantern, began deciphering the few hastily scrawled words.
"I cannot quite reach you without risking your lives and endangering the success of your rescue. When you receive this, wait 2 minutes, then creep out of the hut one by one. Turn to your left sharply and creep cautiously down the cliff. Keep to the left all the time, till you reach the first rock, which you see jutting far out to sea. Behind it, in the creek, the boat is on the lookout for you. Give a long, sharp whistle. She will come up. Get into her. My men will row you to the schooner and thence to England and safety. Once on board the Daydream, send the boat back for me. Tell my men that I shall be at the creek, which is in a direct line opposite the Chagrin near Calais. They know it. I shall be there as soon as possible. They must wait for me at a safe distance out at sea till they hear the usual signal. Do not delay and obey these instructions implicitly."
"Then there is the signature, citoyen,"
added the sergeant, as he handed the paper back to Chauvelin. But the latter had not waited an instant. One phrase of the momentous scrawl had caught his ear. "I shall be at the creek which is in a direct line opposite the Chagrin near Calais." That phrase might yet mean victory for him.
"Which of you knows this coast well?"
he shouted to his men, who now one by one had all returned from their fruitless run, and were all assembled once more round the hut.
"I do, citoyen," said one of them. "I was born in Calais and know every stone of these cliffs." "There is a creek in a direct line from the Chagrin?"
"Oh, there is, citoyen, I know it well."
"The Englishman is hoping to reach that creek. He does not know every stone of these cliffs. He may go there by the longest way round, and in any case he will proceed cautiously for fear of the patrols. At any rate, there is a chance to get him yet. 1,000 francs to each man who gets to that creek before that long-legged Englishman."
"I know a shortcut across the cliffs," said the soldier, and with an enthusiastic shout he rushed forward, followed closely by his comrades. Within a few minutes their running footsteps had died away in the distance. Chauvelin listened to them for a moment. The promise of the reward was lending spurs to the soldiers of the Republic. The gleam of hate and anticipated triumph was once more apparent on his face. Close to him, Degas still stood mute and impassive, waiting for further orders, whilst two soldiers were kneeling beside the prostrate form of Marguerite. Chauvelin gave his secretary a vicious look. His well-laid plan had failed. Its sequel was problematical. There was still a great chance now that the Scarlet Pimpernel might yet escape, and Chauvelin, with that unreasoning fury which sometimes assails a strong nature, was longing to vent his rage on somebody. The soldiers were holding Marguerite pinioned to the ground, though she, poor soul, was not making the faintest struggle. Overwrought nature had at last peremptorily asserted herself, and she lay there in a dead swoon, her eyes circled by deep purple lines that told of long, sleepless nights, her hair matted and damp round her forehead, her lips parted in a sharp curve that spoke of physical pain. The cleverest woman in Europe, the elegant and fashionable Lady Blakeney, who had dazzled London society with her beauty, her wit, and her extravagances, presented a very pathetic picture of tired-out, suffering womanhood, which would have appealed to any but the hard, vengeful heart of her baffled enemy. "It is no use mounting guard over a woman who is half dead," he said spitefully to the soldiers, "when you have allowed five men who are very much alive to escape." Obediently the soldiers rose to their feet. "You'd better try and find that footpath again for me, and that broken-down cart we left on the road." Then suddenly a bright idea seemed to strike him. "Ah, by the by, where is the Jew?"
"Close by, citoyen," said Degas. "I gagged him and tied his legs together as you commanded."
From the immediate vicinity a plaintive moan reached Chauvelin's ears. He followed his secretary, who led the way to the other side of the hut, where, fallen into an absolute heap of dejection, with his legs tightly pinioned together and his mouth gagged, lay the unfortunate descendant of Israel. His face, in the silvery light of the moon, looked positively ghastly with terror. His eyes were wide open and almost glassy, and his whole body was trembling as if with ague, while a piteous wail escaped his bloodless lips. The rope, which had originally been wound round his shoulders and arms, had evidently given way, for it lay in a tangle about his body, but he seemed quite unconscious of this, for he had not made the slightest attempt to move from the place where Degas had originally put him. Like a terrified chicken which looks upon a line of white chalk drawn on a table, as on a string which paralyzes its movements.
"Bring the cowardly brute here," commanded Chauvelin.
He certainly felt exceedingly vicious, and since he had no reasonable grounds for venting his ill-humour on the soldiers who had but too punctually obeyed his orders, he felt that the son of the despised race would prove an excellent butt. With true French contempt of the Jew, which has survived the lapse of centuries even to this day, he would not go too near him, but said with biting sarcasm, as the wretched old man was brought in full light of the moon by the two soldiers,
"I suppose now that, being a Jew, you have a good memory for bargains?"
"Answer,"
he again commanded, as the Jew with trembling lip seemed too frightened to speak.
"Yes, Your Honour,"
stammered the poor wretch.
"You remember, then, the one you and I made together in Calais, when you undertook to overtake Reuben Goldstein, his nag, and my friend the tall stranger, eh?"
But, Your Honour..."
"There is no but. I said, do you remember?"
Yes, Your Honour."
"What was the bargain?"
There was dead silence. The unfortunate man looked round at the great cliffs, the moon above, the stolid faces of the soldiers, and even at the poor, prostrate, inanimate woman close by, but said nothing.
"Will you speak?" thundered Chauvelin menacingly.
He did try, poor wretch, but obviously he could not. There was no doubt, however, that he knew what to expect from the stern man before him.
"Your Honour,"
he ventured imploringly.
"Since your terror seems to have paralysed your tongue," said Chauvelin sarcastically, "I must needs refresh your memory. It was agreed between us that if we overtook my friend the tall stranger before he reached this place, you were to have 10 pieces of gold."
A low moan escaped from the Jew's trembling lips. But, added Chauvelin with slow emphasis, if you deceived me in your promise, you were to have a sound beating, one that would teach you not to tell lies.
I did not, Your Honor. I swear it by Abraham.
And by all the other patriarchs I know. Unfortunately, they are still in Hades, I believe, according to your creed, and cannot help you much in your present trouble. Now, you did not fulfill your share of the bargain, but I am ready to fulfill mine. Here, he added, turning to the soldiers, the buckle end of your two belts to this confounded Jew. As the soldiers obediently unbuckled their heavy leather belts, the Jew set up a howl that surely would have been enough to bring all the patriarchs out of Hades and elsewhere to defend their descendant from the brutality of this French official. I think I can rely on you, citoyen soldiers, laughed Chauvelin maliciously, to give this old liar the best and soundest beating he has ever experienced. But don't kill him, he added dryly. We will obey, citoyen, replied the soldiers as imperturbably as ever. He did not wait to see his orders carried out. He knew that he could trust these soldiers, who were still smarting under his rebuke, not to mince matters when given a free hand to belabour a third party. When that lumbering coward has had his punishment, he said to Degas, the men can guide us as far as the cart, and one of them can drive us in it back to Calais. The Jew and the woman can look after each other, he added roughly, until we can send somebody for them in the morning. They can't run away very far in their present condition, and we cannot be troubled with them just now. Chauvelin had not given up all hope. His men, he knew, were spurred on by the hope of the reward. That enigmatic and audacious Scarlet Pimpernel, alone and with 30 men at his heels, could not reasonably be expected to escape a second time. But he felt less sure now. The Englishman's audacity had baffled him once, whilst the wooden-headed stupidity of the soldiers and the interference of a woman had turned his hand, which held all the trumps, into a losing one. If Marguerite had not taken up his time, if the soldiers had had a grain of intelligence, if— It was a long if, and Chauvelin stood for a moment quite still and enrolled 30-odd people in one long, overwhelming anathema. Nature, poetic, silent, balmy, the bright moon, the calm, silvery sea spoke of beauty and of rest. And Chauvelin cursed nature, cursed man and woman, and, above all, he cursed all long-legged, meddlesome British enigmas with one gigantic curse. The howls of the Jew behind him, undergoing his punishment, sent a balm through his heart, overburdened as it was with revengeful malice. He smiled. It eased his mind to think that some human being at least was, like himself, not altogether at peace with mankind. He turned and took a last look at the lonely bit of coast, where stood the wooden hut, now bathed in moonlight, the scene of the greatest discomfiture ever experienced by a leading member of the Committee of Public Safety. Against a rock, on a hard bed of stone, lay the unconscious figure of Marguerite Blakeney, while some few paces further on, the unfortunate Jew was receiving on his broad back the blows of two stout leather belts, wielded by the stolid arms of two sturdy soldiers of the Republic. The howls of Benjamin Rosenbaum were fit to make the dead rise from their graves. They must have wakened all the gulls from sleep and made them look down with great interest at the doings of the lords of the creation. Well, that will do, commanded Chauvelin, as the Jew's moans became more feeble, and the poor wretch seemed to have fainted away. We don't want to kill him. Obediently the soldiers buckled on their belts, one of them viciously kicking the Jew to one side. Leave him there, said Chauvelin, and lead the way now quickly to the cart. I'll follow. He walked up to where Marguerite lay and looked down into her face. She had evidently recovered consciousness and was making feeble efforts to raise herself. Her large blue eyes were looking at the moonlit scene round her with a scared and terrified look. They rested with a mixture of horror and pity on the Jew, whose luckless fate and wild howls had been the first signs that struck her with her returning senses. Then she caught sight of Chauvelin in his neat, dark clothes, which seemed hardly crumpled after the stirring events of the last few hours. He was smiling sarcastically, and his pale eyes peered down at her with a look of intense malice. With mock gallantry he stooped and raised her icy-cold hand to his lips, which sent a thrill of indescribable loathing through Marguerite's weary frame. "I much regret, fair lady," he said in his most suave tones, "that circumstances over which I have no control compel me to leave you here for the moment. But I go away secure in the knowledge that I do not leave you unprotected. Our friend Benjamin here, though a trifle the worse for wear at the present moment, will prove a gallant defender of your fair person, I have no doubt. At dawn I will send an escort for you. Until then, I feel sure that you will find him devoted, though perhaps a trifle slow." Marguerite only had the strength to turn her head away. Her heart was broken with cruel anguish. One awful thought had returned to her mind, together with gathering consciousness. What had become of Percy? What of Armand? She knew nothing of what had happened after she heard the cheerful song, "God Save the King," which she believed to be the signal of death. "I myself," concluded Chauvelin, "must now very reluctantly leave you. Au revoir, fair lady. We meet, I hope, soon in London. Shall I see you at the Prince of Wales' garden party? No? Ah, well. Au revoir. Remember me, I pray, to Sir Percy Blakeney." And with a last ironical smile and bow, he once more kissed her hand and disappeared down the footpath in the wake of the soldiers, and followed by the imperturbable Degas. Chapter 31. The Last Chapter. The Escape. Marguerite listened, half-dazed as she was, to the fast-retreating firm footsteps of the four men. All nature was so still that she, lying with her ear close to the ground, could distinctly trace the sound of their tread as they ultimately turned into the road, and presently the faint echo of the old cartwheels, the halting gait of the lean nag, told her that her enemy was a quarter of a league away. How long she lay there she knew not. She had lost count of time. Dreamily she looked up at the moonlit sky and listened to the monotonous roll of the waves. The invigorating scent of the sea was nectar to her wearied body. The immensity of the lonely cliffs was silent and dreamlike. Her brain only remained conscious of its ceaseless, its intolerable torture of uncertainty. She did not know. She did not know whether Percy was even now, at this moment, in the hands of the soldiers of the Republic, enduring, as she had done herself, the jibes and jeers of his malicious enemy. She did not know, on the other hand, whether Armand's lifeless body did not lie there in the hut, whilst Percy had escaped, only to hear that his wife's hands had guided the human bloodhounds to the murder of Armand and his friends. The physical pain of utter weariness was so great that she hoped confidently her tired body could rest here forever, after all the turmoil, the passion, and the intrigues of the last few days. Here, beneath that clear sky, within sound of the sea, and with this balmy autumn breeze whispering to her a last lullaby. All was so solitary, so silent, like unto dreamland. Even the last faint echo of the distant cart had long ago died away afar. Suddenly, a sound, the strangest undoubtedly that these lonely cliffs of France had ever heard, broke the silent solemnity of the shore. So strange was it that the gentle breeze ceased to murmur, the tiny pebbles to roll down the steep incline. So strange that Marguerite, wearied, overwrought as she was, thought that the beneficial unconsciousness of the approach of death was playing her half-sleeping senses a weird and elusive trick. It was the sound of a good, solid, absolutely British "Damn!" The seagulls in their nest awoke and looked round in astonishment. A distant and solitary owl set up a midnight hoot. The tall cliffs frowned down majestically at the strange, unheard-of sacrilege. Marguerite did not trust her ears. Half raising herself on her hands, she strained every sense to see or hear, to know the meaning of this very earthly sound. All was still again for the space of a few seconds. The same silence once more fell upon the great and lonely vastness. Then Marguerite, who listened as in a trance, who felt she must be dreaming with that cool, magnetic moonlight overhead, heard again. And this time her heart stood still. Her eyes, large and dilated, looked round her, not daring to trust to her other sense. "Odd's life! But I wish those damned fellows had not hit quite so hard." This time it was quite unmistakable. Only one particular pair of essentially British lips could have uttered those words in sleepy, drawly, affected tones. "Damn!" repeated those same British lips emphatically.
Zounds, but I'm as weak as a rat.
In a moment Marguerite was on her feet. Was she dreaming? Were those great stony cliffs the gates of paradise? Was the fragrant breath of the breeze suddenly caused by the flutter of angels' wings, bringing tidings of unearthly joys to her after all her sufferings, or, faint and ill, was she the prey of delirium? She listened again, and once again she heard the same very earthly sounds of good, honest British language, not the least akin to whisperings from paradise or flutter of angels' wings. She looked round her eagerly at the tall cliffs, the lonely hut, the great stretch of rocky beach. Somewhere there, above or below her, behind a boulder or inside a crevice, but still hidden from her longing, feverish eyes, must be the owner of that voice, which once used to irritate her, but which now would make the happiest woman in Europe, if only she could locate it. "Percy! Percy!" she shrieked hysterically, tortured between doubt and hope. "I am here! Come to me! Where are you, Percy? Percy!"
"It's all very well calling me, my dear," said the same sleepy, drawly voice. "But odd's life, I cannot come to you. Those damned frog-eaters have trussed me like a goose on a spit, and I'm as weak as a mouse. I cannot get away."
And still Marguerite did not understand. She did not realize for at least another 10 seconds whence came that voice, so drawly, so dear, but alas, with a strange accent of weakness and of suffering. There was no one within sight, except by that rock. Great God! The Jew! Was he mad or dreaming? His back was against the pale moonlight. He was half-crouching, trying vainly to raise himself with his arms tightly pinioned. Marguerite ran up to him, took his head in both her hands, and looked straight into a pair of blue eyes, good-natured, even a trifle amused, shining out of the weird and distorted mask of the Jew.
"Percy, Percy, my husband!" she gasped, faint with the fullness of her joy. "Thank God! Thank God!"
"La, my dear," he rejoined good-humouredly, "we will both do that anon, and you think you can loosen these damned ropes and release me from my inelegant attitude?"
She had no knife, her fingers were numb and weak, but she worked away with her teeth, while great welcome tears poured from her eyes onto those poor pinioned hands.
"Odd's life," he said, when at last, after frantic efforts on her part, the rope seemed at last to be giving way. "But I marvel whether it has ever happened before that an English gentleman allowed himself to be licked by a damned foreigner and made no attempt to give as good as he got."
It was very obvious that he was exhausted from sheer physical pain, and when at last the rope gave way, he fell in a heap against the rock. Marguerite looked helplessly round her.
"Oh, for a drop of water on this awful beach!" she cried in agony, seeing that he was ready to faint again.
"Nay, my dear," he murmured with his good-humoured smile. "Personally, I should prefer a drop of good French brandy, and you'll dive in the pocket of this dirty old garment, you'll find my flask. I'm damned if I can move."
When he had drunk some brandy, he forced Marguerite to do likewise.
"Ah, that's better now, hey, little woman?" he said, with a sigh of satisfaction. "Hey-ho, but this is a queer rig-up for Sir Percy Blakeney, Baronet, to be found in by his lady, and no mistake. Begad," he added, passing his hand over his chin. "I haven't been shaved for nearly 20 hours. I must look a disgusting object. As for these curls—"
And laughingly he took off the disfiguring wig and curls, and stretched out his long limbs, which were cramped from many hours stooping. Then he bent forward and looked long and searchingly into his wife's blue eyes.
"Percy,"
she whispered, while a deep blush suffused her delicate cheeks and neck,
"if you only knew—"
"I do know, dear, everything," he said with infinite gentleness.
"And can you ever forgive?"
"I have naught to forgive, sweetheart. Your heroism, your devotion, which I, alas, so little deserved, have more than atoned for that unfortunate episode at the ball."
"Then you knew," she whispered, "all the time?"
"Yes," he replied tenderly, "I knew all the time. But, begad, had I but known what a noble heart yours was, my Margot, I should have trusted you as you deserved to be trusted, and you would not have had to undergo the terrible sufferings of the past few hours in order to run after a husband who has done so much that needs forgiveness."
They were sitting side by side, leaning up against a rock, and he had rested his aching head on her shoulder. She certainly now deserved the name of
the happiest woman in Europe. "It is a case of the blind leading the lame, sweetheart, is it not?" he said with his good-natured smile of old. "Odd's life, but I do not know which are the more sore, my shoulders or your little feet." He bent forward to kiss them, for they peeped out through her torn stockings and bore pathetic witness to her endurance and devotion. "But Armand," she said with sudden terror and remorse, as in the midst of her happiness the image of the beloved brother for whose sake she had so deeply sinned rose now before her mind. "No, have no fear for Armand, sweetheart," he said tenderly. "Did I not pledge you my word that he should be safe? He with de Tournay and the others are even now on board the Daydream."
"But how?" she gasped. "I do not understand."
"Oh, yet it is simple enough, my dear," he said, with that funny, half-shy, half-inane laugh of his. "You see, when I found that brute Chauvelin meant to stick to me like a leech, I thought the best thing I could do, as I could not shake him off, was to take him along with me. I had to get to Armand and the others somehow, and all the roads were patrolled, and everyone on the lookout for your humble servant. I knew that when I slipped through Chauvelin's fingers at the Chagri, that he would lie in wait for me here, whichever way I took. I wanted to keep an eye on him and his doings, and a British head is as good as a French one any day." Indeed, it had proved to be infinitely better, and Marguerite's heart was filled with joy and marvel as he continued to recount to her the daring manner in which he had snatched the fugitives away right from under Chauvelin's very nose. "Dressed as the dirty old Jew," he said gaily, "I knew I should not be recognized. I had met Reuben Goldstein in Calais earlier in the evening. For a few gold pieces he supplied me with this rig out, and undertook to bury himself out of sight of everybody whilst he lent me his cart and nag."
"But if Chauvelin had discovered you," she gasped excitedly, "your disguise was good, but he is so sharp."
"Odd's fish," he rejoined quietly. "Then certainly the game would have been up. I could but take the risk. I know human nature pretty well by now," he added, with a note of sadness in his cheery young voice, "and I know these Frenchmen out and out. They so loathe a Jew that they never come nearer than a couple of yards of him, and begad, I fancy that I contrive to make myself look about as loathsome an object as it is possible to conceive."
"Yes? And then?" she asked eagerly.
"Well, zooks! Then I carried out my little plan. That is to say, at first I only determined to leave everything to chance. But when I heard Chauvelin giving his orders to the soldiers, I thought that fate and I were going to work together after all. I reckoned on the blind obedience of the soldiers. Chauvelin had ordered them on pain of death not to stir until the tall Englishman came. Degas had thrown me down in a heap quite close to the hut. The soldiers took no notice of the Jew who had driven citoyen Chauvelin to this spot. I managed to free my hands from the ropes with which the brute had trussed me. I always carry pencil and paper with me wherever I go, and I hastily scrawled a few important instructions on a scrap of paper. Then I looked about me. I crawled up to the hut under the very noses of the soldiers, who lay under cover without stirring, just as Chauvelin had ordered them to do. Then I dropped my little note into the hut through a chink in the wall and waited. In this note I told the fugitives to walk noiselessly out of the hut, creep down the cliffs, keep to the left until they came to the first creek, to give a certain signal, when the boat of the Daydream, which lay in wait not far out to sea, would pick them up. They obeyed implicitly, fortunately for them and for me. The soldiers who saw them were equally obedient to Chauvelin's orders. They did not stir. I waited for nearly half an hour. When I knew that the fugitives were safe, I gave the signal, which caused so much stir. And that was the whole story. It seemed so simple, and Marguerite could but marvel at the wonderful ingenuity, the boundless pluck and audacity which had evolved and helped to carry out this daring plan.
"But those brutes struck you," she gasped in horror
at the bare recollection of the fearful indignity. "Well, that could not be helped," he said gently. "Whilst my little wife's fate was so uncertain, I had to remain here by her side. Odd's life," he added merrily, "never fear. Chauvelin will lose nothing by waiting, I warrant. Wait till I get him back to England. Ah, he shall pay for the thrashing he gave me with compound interest, I promise you." Marguerite laughed. It was so good to be beside him, to hear his cheery voice, to watch that good-humoured twinkle in his blue eyes as he stretched out his strong arms in longing for that foe and anticipation of his well-deserved punishment. Suddenly, however, she started. The happy blush left her cheek. The light of joy died out of her eyes. She had heard a stealthy footfall overhead, and a stone had rolled down from the top of the cliffs right down to the beach below. "What's that?" she whispered in horror and alarm. "Oh, nothing, my dear," he muttered with a pleasant laugh. "Only a trifle you happen to have forgotten. My friend Ffoulkes."
"Sir Andrew," she gasped.
Indeed, she had wholly forgotten the devoted friend and companion who had trusted and stood by her during all these hours of anxiety and suffering. She remembered him now, tardily and with a pang of remorse.
"Ah, you had forgotten him, hadn't you, my dear?" said Sir Percy merrily. "Fortunately, I met him not far from the Chat Gris, before I had that interesting supper-party with my friend Chauvelin. Odd's life, but I have a score to settle with that young reprobate. But in the meanwhile I told him of a very long, very roundabout road that would bring him here by a very circuitous road which Chauvelin's men would never suspect, just about the time when we are ready for him, eh, little woman?"
"And he obeyed?" asked Marguerite, in utter astonishment.
"Without word or question. See, here he comes. He was not in the way when I did not want him, and now he arrives in the nick of time. Now he will make pretty little Suzanne a most admirable and methodical husband."
In the meanwhile, Sir Andrew Ffoulkes had cautiously worked his way down the cliffs. He stopped once or twice, pausing to listen for the whispered words which would guide him to Blakeney's hiding-place.
"Blakeney," he ventured to say at last cautiously, "Blakeney, are you there?"
The next moment he rounded the rock against which Sir Percy and Marguerite were leaning, and seeing the weird figure still clad in the long Jew's gabardine, he paused in sudden, complete bewilderment. But already Blakeney had struggled to his feet.
"Here I am, friend," he said with his funny, inane laugh, "all alive, though I do look a begad scarecrow in these damned things."
"Zooks!" ejaculated Sir Andrew in boundless astonishment as he recognised his leader. "Of all the—" The young man had seen Marguerite, and happily checked the forcible language that rose to his lips at sight of the exquisite Sir Percy in this weird and dirty garb.
"Yes," said Blakeney calmly, "of all the—" "My friend, I have not yet had time to ask you what you were doing in France when I ordered you to remain in London. Insubordination, what? Wait till my shoulders are less sore, and by gad see the punishment you'll get."
"What's fish, I'll bear it," said Sir Andrew with a merry laugh, "seeing that you are alive to give it. Would you have had me allow Lady Blakeney to do the journey alone? But in the name of heaven, man, where did you get these extraordinary clothes?"
"A lot they are a bit quaint, ain't they?" laughed Sir Percy jovially. "Well, odds fish," he added with sudden earnestness and authority. "Now you are here, Ffoulkes, we must lose no more time. That brute Chauvelin may send someone to look after us."
Marguerite was so happy she could have stayed here forever, hearing his voice, asking 100 questions. But at mention of Chauvelin's name she started in quick alarm, afraid for the dear life she would have died to save.
"But how can we get back?" she gasped. "The roads are full of soldiers between here and Calais, and—"
"We are not going back to Calais, sweetheart," he said, "but just the other side of Grenay, not half a league from here. The boat of the Daydream will meet us there."
"The boat of the Daydream?"
"Yes," he said, with a merry laugh. "Another little trick of mine. I should have told you before that when I slipped that note into the hut, I also added another for Armand, which I directed him to leave behind, and which has sent Chauvelin and his men running full tilt back to the Chat Gris after me. But the first little note contained my real instructions, including those to old Briggs. He had my orders to go out further to sea, and then towards the west. When well out of sight of Calais, he will send the galley to a little creek he and I know of, just beyond Grenay. The men will look out for me, we have a preconcerted signal, and we will all be safely aboard whilst Chauvelin and his men solemnly sit and watch the creek, which is just opposite the Chat Gris."
"The other side of Grenay? But I cannot walk, Percy,"
she moaned helplessly, as, trying to struggle to her tired feet, she found herself unable even to stand.
"I will carry you, dear," he said simply. "The blind leading the lame, you know."
Sir Andrew was ready, too, to help with the precious burden, but Sir Percy would not entrust his beloved to any arms but his own.
"When you and she are both safely on board the Daydream," he said to his young comrade, "and I feel that Mademoiselle Suzanne's eyes will not greet me in England with reproachful looks, then it will be my turn to rest." and his arms, still vigorous in spite of fatigue and suffering, closed round Marguerite's poor, weary body, and lifted her as gently as if she had been a feather. Then, as Sir Andrew discreetly kept out of earshot, there were many things said, or rather whispered, which even the autumn breeze did not catch, for it had gone to rest. All his fatigue was forgotten. His shoulders must have been very sore, for the soldiers had hit hard. But the man's muscles seemed made of steel, and his energy was almost supernatural. It was a weary tramp, half a league along the stony side of the cliffs, but never for a moment did his courage give way or his muscles yield to fatigue. On he tramped, with firm footstep, his vigorous arms encircling the precious burden, and, no doubt, as she lay quiet and happy, at times lulled to momentary drowsiness, at others watching through the slowly gathering morning light, the pleasant face with the lazy, drooping blue eyes, ever cheerful, ever illumined with a good-humoured smile, she whispered many things which helped to shorten the weary road and acted as a soothing balsam to his aching sinews. The many-hued light of dawn was breaking in the east when at last they reached the creek beyond Greenay. The galley lay in wait. In answer to a signal from Sir Percy, she drew near, and two sturdy British sailors had the honour of carrying my lady into the boat. Half an hour later they were on board the Daydream. The crew, who of necessity were in their master's secrets, and who were devoted to him heart and soul, were not surprised to see him arriving in so extraordinary a disguise. Armand Saint-Just and the other fugitives were eagerly awaiting the advent of their brave rescuer. He would not stay to hear the expressions of their gratitude, but found his way to his private cabin as quickly as he could, leaving Marguerite quite happy in the arms of her brother. Everything on board the Daydream was fitted with that exquisite luxury so dear to Sir Percy Blakeney's heart, and by the time they all landed at Dover he had found time to get into some of the sumptuous clothes which he loved, and of which he always kept a supply on board his yacht. The difficulty was to provide Marguerite with a pair of shoes, and great was the little middy's joy when my lady found she could put foot on English shore in his best pair. The rest is silence. Silence and joy for those who had endured so much suffering, yet found at last a great and lasting happiness. But it is on record that at the brilliant wedding of Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, Baronet, with Mademoiselle Suzanne de Tournay de Basserive, a function at which His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales and all the elite of fashionable society were present, the most beautiful woman there was unquestionably Lady Blakeney, whilst the clothes Sir Percy Blakeney wore were the talk of the jeunesse dorée of London for many days. It is also a fact that Monsieur Chauvelin, the accredited agent of the French Republican government, was not present at that or any other social function in London after that memorable evening at Lord Grenville's ball. This concludes the reading of The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Orczy. This book was read by Ralph Cosham. This book was first published in London in 1905. This unabridged recording was produced in 2005 by Blackstone Audio Books, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Books. If you would like to obtain a complete catalogue of our titles, or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.